Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to many deprivations, from the serious, like adequate food and medical care, to the less so, like our hobbies and leisure time activities. If you're a sports fan, the pandemic has challenged the rhythms, normalcy, and traditions we associate with sport. A year ago, all professional and amateur athletic leagues, including colleges, were shut down, in some cases for months before cautiously re-emerging to the fields and courts of play under new restrictions for players, coaches, and fans, in most cases not even allowing fans to be present, except watching at home on television. Perhaps the most famous example of this is the National Basketball Association's bubble in Orlando, Florida, which lasted from July to October 2020 and allowed the league to finish its season and crown a new titleist, in this case, the Los Angeles Lakers. The National Football League was able to complete a full schedule of games, albeit with postponements and structural changes, including some California teams moving to different states to both practice and compete. My guest today, journalist Larry Olmsted, explores the health benefits of being a sports fan. In his new book, Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. Fandom is not a well-explored area of inquiry, but what research there is shows us that contrary to popular belief, sports fans are more likely to engage in physical activity than the stereotypical beer-swilling couch potato. And sports fandom has hugely beneficial effects on our mental health, bringing families and communities together, with research again showing net positive effects of engaging with sports. Larry Olmsted is a longtime journalist who's written for more than two decades for outlets such as Popular Science, Outside, Men's Health, Inc., Worth, The Rob Report, and Golf Magazine, just to name a few. He's also written for newspapers ranging from Boston Globe, New York Daily News, and many others. His previous book was a bestseller called Real Food, Fake Food, as Olmsted writes frequently about both food and travel. Larry Olmsted, author of the new book, Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Larry Olmsted, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by having you just tell us about what motivated you to write this book, Fans.
Well, I actually came at it from sort of the opposite perspective originally. I went to a baseball game at Fenway Park in Boston years ago and saw this couple with two very young children dressed in T-shirts with obscenities aimed at the New York Yankees. And I left the game wondering, you know, what's wrong with those people? And I started to think, you know, maybe there's something about sports fandom that makes us crazy or, you know, do bad things. And I should look into that. So I started doing the research, and almost as soon as I dove into the science and the data, I saw that, you know, that was completely wrong. The opposite was true. And the reason they made such an impact on me was because they were the outliers. There were 40,000 other people at the game that day who I didn't remember and didn't bother me because most sports fans are happy and well-adjusted. And, you know, I've come to see that the, you know, sports fandom is complicated, but it's overwhelmingly beneficial.
Yeah, so I was intrigued. I mean, I have to admit, I was skeptical when I got the book, and I thought, like a sort of a scientific exploration of being a sports fan. Is nothing sacred? Can't we just be fans? But I have to say, I came away kind of really impressed. And I also wanted to just ask you, you frame the book as kind of a series of conversations, if you will, with Dr. Christie. Tell us about Dr. Christie and kind of why you chose to write in that framework.
Well, I had done most of the research, but I hadn't figured out how to structure the book. And I actually taught a college class on structuring nonfiction narrative. So it's something I think about a lot, you know, what would be the perfect structure. And when you get into researching any topic, and when you know a lot about any topic, you tend to see it from the sort of insider's perspective. So I went skiing one day in Jackson Hole with this, you know, real-life friend of mine, and she's a physician. I changed her name so she wouldn't get bothered by sports fans. But, you know, she's not a sports fan, and she asked me essentially, why are you writing this book? Your last book was about food. You know, what isn't sports a big waste of time? And you know, it kind of shocked me. But I realized that, you know, if you didn't know what I knew, that was, you know, the questions you would ask. So I decided that would be a good way to kick it off.
Well, I did like that frame a lot because, you know, I'm a skeptical doctor. She was a skeptical doctor. And as you point out, I guess initially, you know, she's someone who's very athletic. You were with her on the ski slopes. She, I guess, performed a lot of other athletic feats, both growing up and in her adult life, but didn't see being a sports fan is particularly healthy or worthwhile. But at least in the narrative, you seem to kind of convince her that sports fans, in effect, are healthier, physically healthier, because we have, a stereotype, which you share with your readers, that we tend to think of the SNL trope of the Bears fans, the Bears, tend to be heavy set, beer swilling, mostly men, although women too. But that's really just kind of an image we have. It's not actually what the evidence bears out.
No, it's definitely not. And I did do a kind of a deep dive. I looked at every sitcom and movie I could find that was about sports fans, and it's the universally negative stereotype: always overweight, almost all men, as you said, even though almost half of sports fans are women. But the data says that sports fans are more active than non-fans, and some of that is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because some people become sports fans because they're already active. They played a little league, or they play sports, so they want to watch sports. So what I tried to find was clear-cut examples of what I call this participation effect, where otherwise sedentary people are motivated to become active simply because they watch spectator sport. Because I think that, obviously we live in a society that has some obesity issues and diabetes issues and, public health issues around, people being not active enough. So I thought, if one of the things sports did was actually get people to exercise more, wouldn't that be great? And I found plenty of evidence of that.
Can you share with us some of that evidence? I was kind of pleasantly surprised. I guess I shouldn't have been, because Lord knows there's research about pretty much everything. some of it seems, sometimes pretty soft, or in some of the psychology literature. But this was pretty interesting stuff, like Dr. Wan, for example.
Yeah, so Dr. Wan at Murray State is a psychologist who is probably, certainly America's leading researcher of sports fandom, if not the world's. Hundreds of papers, collaborated on books. I got the opportunity to go to an annual sports psychology conference that he co-hosts down in Kentucky. But, most of his, they do a lot of questionnaires, so they'll ask people, about their exercise habits and stuff. But he's more interested in the mental health perspective. What I found with the physical side is, the most interesting thing to me was probably the Olympics, especially, because growing up for me, it was always every 4 years, but now it's every 2 years, so it has a little bit more of a relevance. And after every Olympics, there's a big spike in gym membership sign-up and participation in what you would call general fitness, classes, because, people, especially a lot of people who maybe don't watch as much sports, suddenly see these examples of training and athletic excellence and something they want to emulate.
Yes, indeed. And I guess I wasn't aware of that Olympic effect, but it really was interesting. And I'm an Olympic fan, along with many other sports, so I guess it doesn't come as a great surprise that it has that salutatory effect on people, that they see these tremendous athletes performing at the world's highest level of achievement, and then go out and sign up for classes or to try something new, which is pretty neat.
Right, and one of the things that's been documented is it, the rise in participation is especially high in new sports, and every Olympics has some new sports. So even when they introduced beach volleyball, there was a big spike in people playing beach volleyball, because you've seen the track and field for years. But this coming Olympics, Tokyo, if it comes off, if not, they're still going to have these new sports in Paris. The two new sports are surfing and rock climbing, and I think both of those are going to see really big spikes, because they're exciting to watch, kind of adrenaline sports that most people have never seen on TV, and they're relatively accessible. You could take a two-hour learn to surf lesson at any beach resort in the world, and the climbing is going to be indoor, which you can do anywhere in the middle of a big city. So, I think you're going to see a lot of people say, "Hey, I want to go to a climbing gym."
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is author Larry Olmsted. His new book is called Fans: How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. And Larry, we talked a little bit about how participation tends to increase after the Olympics, and some of the psychology literature shows that people tend to be more engaged physically when they are sports fans. But there's definitely a mental health effect as well. And you point this out. I mean, we're in the still in the midst, I guess, or hopefully entering the final phase, I would like to think, of a pandemic. And sports has had a huge role, I would say, both its absence early on in the pandemic and then its kind of tentative return to I'm thinking of the NBA bubble here. And then in the fall, you know, in spite of many hiccups, we had a full NFL football season, sort of an abbreviated, in a way, college football season. But this has been a real salve during the pandemic. This book, I think, was written kind of before the pandemic, but you were able to, I guess, get some material in there?
Yeah, I had pretty much finished it before the pandemic, but then I had some time on my hands because I could no longer travel, which is something I usually do a lot for work. So I went back and revisited with some of the psychologists the topics of the pandemic and I was able to, right when sport returned, get in some of the TV rating information to see, you know, what it was like after the absence. But that hits, you know, on several things because, you know, in general, you know, sports makes us happier. So, you know, we want to be happier during the pandemic, but it also has played this consistent role throughout history in healing communities with public trauma, post 9/11, things like that. And that sort of, this pandemic is like that, except it's the first thing of its kind on such a global scale that affected, you know, every place and every sport in the world basically shut down. So, you know, it was the longest in modern history that, you know, we've kind of gone without any sports on TV. And even when, like, European soccer returned was the first thing on, you know, Fox Sports, and the ratings were like 500% up from any European soccer that had been on before. So people were definitely eager for the return. And I've got, anecdotally, a lot of people have told me or sent me emails saying, you know, they watched more sports than ever in the past year, and thank God for sports.
Yeah, and in addition, there were those pretty highly watched documentaries, or if some people, I guess, scoff at the notion that the Michael Jordan six-part series, The Last Dance, that aired on a few networks, I guess ESPN and then yep. ABC, that in some phases he was seen as having total control over that project, so it wasn't really seen as a documentary, as biased, but I definitely watched it. It was actually quite fascinating and compelling, and I think the ratings for that were sky high.
Yeah, it was by a significant magnitude, the highest rated documentary ever from ESPN, and they made a lot of them. So, you know, and that was the only game in town when it was on TV, and it was like the perfect time for it. But it's also interesting, you know, you mentioned the bubble and some of these things. I actually wrote an op-ed for the New York Daily News about this. I mean, sports actually, in addition to, you know, giving us some emotional inspiration and distraction, also taught us some valuable lessons. Nobody used the term bubble before the NBA and the NHL did it, and then suddenly, you know, it was good in our own lives to have our bubbles. And, you know, the NFL put a real big emphasis on mask wearing and was fining coaches significant amount of money for showing up on TV without their masks. So there was a lot of messaging that I think was good. You know, even a baseball stadium is full of cardboard cutouts, you know, were a reminder that, you know, hey, you should be socially distant. So I think, you know, in a way, we learned a lot from having sports on during the pandemic, and it was good for the public health messaging. And I even read that, you know, the CDC took data from the NFL on, you know, what the actual amount of minutes, you know, you need to be exposed to contract the coronavirus was. So, you know, the working hand in hand with the sports league and the medical community, I found that kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it really is quite fascinating. Well, you mentioned about collective trauma, and you gave the example of 9/11, which you write pretty extensively about in the book. Could you kind of remind us or share with our listeners a little bit about what happened after 9/11 in the sports world and how it did help alleviate some of our collective trauma or bring us together as a nation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, all sports were basically canceled after 9/11. And then, you know, about 10 days later, they started to come back. And the first professional sporting event in New York City after 9/11 was a New York Mets Braves baseball game. And it got significant national attention because it was in New York and it was, you know, people had been, you know, like they are now, kind of staying home after almost any incident like that, people tend to lock down a little bit. So it was the first big public gathering, and they had celebrity entertainers singing the national anthem and all that, and it was sort of transformative. One fan I talked to said, it was the moment it was okay to smile again, and that was on national TV, and people almost everywhere except maybe the Atlanta Braves fans in Atlanta were rooting for the Mets because they thought New York needed a win. And then in typical sports fashion, it was sort of a Cinderella story come from behind. A victory with a home run by the Mets catcher, Mike Piazza. And, there was a woman there whose husband was a fireman who was killed in the World Trade Center. And she took her three children to the game, and she said when that home run went over the wall, it was the first time they had smiled since their dad died. So it's pretty powerful stuff. And actually, this is the 20th anniversary, and Major League Baseball has scheduled a Mets-Yankees game in the Mets Stadium for 9/11, and it's going to be a big deal this fall. You're going to be seeing a lot of reruns of that Mike Piazza home run leading up to that game.
Huh. Well, yeah, that was I had vague recollections of that game, but I didn't really know that level of detail, and so it was very heartwarming to read that account again. And another aspect of the book I like very much is you talk about, in addition to this collective trauma idea, is how sports is often used for good. Sometimes, of course, it can be used to show lots of international competition and rivalries. But the great example you give is in South Africa with a South African rugby. And could you just share that story, too, with our listeners?
Yeah, that is the most obvious example of this role of sports fandom in, the peace process, nation building, reconciliation. And there's a great book about it called Playing the Enemy that was made into a movie with Morgan Freeman and Matt Damon called Invictus. And it's all based on this true story that Nelson Mandela, when at the end of apartheid, he was the first president elected under, the newly democratic government system in South Africa. And, it was basically the end of the white ruling party, minority populist ruling the country. And so there was a lot of opposition to his election, and the country was basically teetering on the brink of civil war. And Mandela knew that the white residents were extremely passionate about rugby, and South Africa had been banned from international competition because of apartheid, so they hadn't been able to participate in the World Cup. So he brought the World Cup to South Africa and basically leveraged the passion for rugby into this national healing movement that preempted civil war and allowed, South Africa to make the transition to democracy. And it's a pretty incredible scale of using sports fandom to affect political change for the better.
Yeah, and it's actually a pretty good movie, too, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, and I should say, I've been to South Africa a few times, so it's a little near and dear to my heart, and I've loved the time I spent there. But I interviewed an American sports fanatic who basically was traveling around the world trying to go to, like, every big sporting event and went to that World Cup not knowing much about the politics or the issues behind it. And he described to me how, when Mandela came out on the field and spoke, you could tell it was like a world-changing event without knowing anything about it. It was so powerful.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Larry Olmsted, writer and author. His new book is called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. And arguably, that's maybe never been as true as it is during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Larry, you have also in here some information about sports and families. And there's a lot in here, but tell us about intergenerational sports fandom and how the impact it has on family structure.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of the common ground because everyone I've talked to, even in other countries, has this memory of going to their first game or watching their first game, with their father, their mother, their grandparents, and it's just a commonality of the sports fandom process. And I mean, I know you know, my earliest memories are my dad taking my brother and I to baseball games at Shea Stadium growing up. And, you know, I've done radio shows with live call-ins and people call in and talk about listening on to the radio on the porch with their grandpa. And I have a good friend of mine who has a teenage daughter and an elderly father, and they all go to the baseball game together and have a good time. But otherwise, they might not have that much to talk about intergenerationally that way. And one professor that I quote in the book said, you know, the kids don't want to hear about what it was like to work in a coal mine, and grandpa doesn't want to hear about video games, but they can all share their passion for sports. And it's something, you know, I talked to a woman who recovered from cancer using sports, her sports fandom as her inspiration, and she told me about, you know, it all came from growing up with her father and watching sports with him before he passed away. So, you know, it's a story that I hear over and over again, and I think it's going to become even more prevalent with the big growth in fantasy sports. And there's a lot of families where mom and dad, or mom and daughter, or mom and son, or dad and daughter, or dad and son co-manage a team, and it's a new way of, you know, kind of sitting around the kitchen table that used to be Monopoly or Scrabble or Gin Rummy is now fantasy sports.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think a lot of our listeners don't necessarily participate in fantasy sports, but I mean, this is a huge business on the one hand, but it's also a huge hobby for millions of Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I remember, you know, when I was growing up, we had like a Strat-O-Matic baseball. It was, like a semi-realistic board game. And the original fantasy sports were really for the super hardcore fans, because you had to track all of, you know, the statistics and do all the math yourself. But with the, you know, advent of the internet, it became super easy because the programs would do it all for you. And that fueled sort of exponential growth in participation. And the last numbers I was able to get had about 60 million people in North America regularly participating in fantasy sports. And that's about a third of all, you know, sports fans. So that's quite a lot of people. And it's still a relatively new thing. And what I found is a lot of people participate in leagues. And the idea is you draft, you form a league, you each have a team, and then you draft real players, but from multiple teams. So it's sort of like an all-star lineup. And a lot of people participate in multiple leagues based around some sort of social connection. Like they have one league, a fantasy league they're in, all with friends from college, one all with coworkers. And that's been another thing during, you know, the pandemic, because it's all can be done online, that has, you know, let people stay connected more through playing fantasy sports. But it's also, yeah, like I said, very good multi-generational, because, you know, you get together with your kid and say, okay, who are we going to draft?
Yeah, and I certainly love the idea of families sitting around the table or collaborating on this together, whether at the table or you know, across the country, because it's now, as you point out, with the internet so amenable to that kind of participation and shared joy. Throughout the book, you have chapters on sports fandom and brain and the brain science. What kinds of connections or discoveries have some of the scientists made about how being a sports fan impacts our brain?
The biggest thing is probably improved and extended cognitive functions. And, you know, some of this is common to any intellectual activity. You know, I think especially as you get older, if you did Sudoku every day or crossword puzzles, you know, it's good for your brains. But sports fandom is good in a similar way. And, you know, some of the psychologists cited examples of older people who can clearly, you know, remember lineups from years ago, you know, might have trouble remembering other things. And like I said, even the fantasy sports, you know, has like that intellectual aspect to it of number crunching. And when I grew up, you know, watching baseball, you know, the stats were pretty simple. We knew what the ERA meant and RBI and batting average. But, you know, along comes Moneyball and what they call sabermetrics. And there's all of these new statistics around baseball that are, you know, super complicated. And all of our sports have gotten more complicated. The defenses and schemes used in football and basketball. You said you watched that Last Dance, you know, documentary, when they're diagramming some of those triangles, you know, I think to be a serious sports fan now is a little bit more of an intellectual exercise, and especially, ironically, you know, with the rise of talk sports radio, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking and second guessing. But to be a critic like that, you have to kind of understand what's going on at a deep level, and it's more cerebral to follow sports, I think, than people would assume.
Yeah, I think those are some really good points, and I echo what you said about The Last Dance, where they did some animation, some diagrams of the triangle offense that I think was the brainchild of this guy Tex Winter, who was the assistant coach for those successful Chicago Bulls teams. And that was the best I ever understood the triangle, because I never understood it when people tried to explain it. But when you could see a picture of it, it made a lot more sense to see how the players moved and why you would get sort of better opportunities for baskets. And of course, as you point out, that technical wizardry is what's intellectually stimulating about it. But then, of course, the human drama of it makes for such compelling sort of serial watching. I want to ask you about your writing. You've had a great career writing all kinds of for all kinds of magazines and newspapers. You wrote another book that was a bestseller, which is also of interest, called Real Food, Fake Food. Share with us the premise of that book.
Sure. I mean, my kind of commonality in journalism has been, you know, trying to find interesting ideas that have not been explored, and that's what, you know, while they're very different topics, they came, you know, from that same perspective of like, wow, people should know this. And Real Food, Fake Food is basically about some of the, in our country, we have very poor protections for a lot of food labeling issues, which enable unscrupulous restaurants, food producers, stores to basically, you know, dupe the public. So it's about why you think you're buying and eating either at the supermarket or restaurant is not always what it pretends to be. But I do it from a sort of glass half empty, or glass half full, I should say, perspective, where, you know, there's great food out there. I love food. I write a lot about food. You should be eating that instead of this crap, rather than it's all poison.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like what you did with this book, where you kind of came at it from the, you know, negative perspective and turned it into a positive, which is kind of nice. I have to ask you, because in your bio it says you once had dinner with Julia Child. Tell us what that was like.
I did. That's sort of my celebrity moment, and it's funny because I've met, you know, a lot of professional athletes and people are like, oh, you know, you met Tiger Woods, whatever. But you know, Julia Child, that's my real claim to fame. And you know, she lived in Boston, kind of famously, her townhouse in Cambridge. And, you know, one of the top rising chefs out of Boston was Todd English. I mean, now he's older and more established. He's about to actually open another new restaurant in Las Vegas. But at the time, he was sort of, you know, like new and really hot and had won a James Beard Award. And he was opening a new restaurant in Boston. And I went to the opening, and so did Julia Child. And we were at my wife and I and her and like three other people sat around a table and had dinner. And it was truly meeting an icon the icon of the food world.
That is great. Well, the name of the book, the new book, is Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. And it's by my guest today, author Larry Olmsted. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Larry Olmsted is a longtime journalist whose new book is called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.